Good afternoon. We're now going to convene the task force on impediments to fair housing choice. And we're going to start off to see if there's any remarks by the chairs. Chairman, any remarks today?
Thank you, Co-Chairman Butler. It's a big day. I think today is we've been meeting a couple of times, and I think today we're going to see something tangible and that we can take away. Looking forward to it. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. And we're going to have a presentation by Aaron Kemple and by Jack Doherty, Associate Professor of Education Studies at Trinity College. But first, we're going to start off with Aaron. It's your show.
I wish I could say it was my show. It's really Orlando. Aaron Boggs is in my show because we've all done significant work on this, and I'm hoping that they can both back me up if there are specific questions that people have. I'm not going to go through the entire report. This is the executive summary, which you all got an outline of, but I think it really hits the highlights of the report and the issues that are raised as a result of it. So, and I have given Peter a copy of the PowerPoint that he can send out to people who want it. I didn't make copies or have him make copies because it's 66 slides, and so I didn't want to kill that many trees. So if you'll remember, the last time that we met, Aaron Boggs presented on an overview of the AI process and what it means to affirmatively further fair housing, who has to affirmatively further fair housing, and what must be included in the analysis of impediments. So I'm not going to go through that again. What I'm going to do today is go through some of the data that we've collected because I think it tells a story about Connecticut in terms of who lives here, where people live, what is the effect of the current housing patterns, and then the impediments and also the action steps to change how Connecticut looks today. And so it is a lot of data, but again, I think the data really tells an important story about Connecticut and about what Connecticut's going to look like in the future. So what we did in the report is we really started with the demographics of Connecticut. Who lives here? And the basic takeaway from this is that Connecticut is a racially diverse state, and its diversity is growing. And when I say race, I mean race and national origin. National origin is generally referred to as Hispanic because that's the terminology that's used in the census. Race is usually used as black because, again, that's terminology used in the census, and it's also more expansive than using African American. White is usually used as non-Hispanic white, and by that what we're trying to indicate is that it is white as a race separate and apart from Hispanic as an ethnicity. So what you can see from this slide is that between 1980 and 2030, our demographics have really changed. If you look at the very last column, in 1980, the total percentage of people of color in the state was 12%. In 2010, as of the last census, it's 28.8%, and it's projected to go up to 39% by 2030. Why? Why is the population of color growing in Connecticut? First of all, and this all has importance for the analysis of impediments because it tells us information about who needs housing and who is going to be living in Connecticut over the next 20 years. So one of the reasons that populations of color are growing in Connecticut is because there are more families with children in the populations of color. So if you look at this slide, which talks about fertility rates, and by fertility rates, what it's really looking at is the number of children per female. So in 1990, the fertility rate was 1.85, so 1.85 children per female. I'm not exactly sure how you have 0.85. Okay, never mind. That's dropped in Connecticut to 1.71. And you'll see that the white non-Hispanic fertility rate has gone up slightly, But if you add the last three, the black non-Hispanic, the Asian non-Hispanic, and the Hispanic, you'll see that the fertility rates are much higher in populations of color, which is one of the reasons that the population of color is rising in Connecticut. The second reason that populations are rising in Connecticut is that foreign-born populations or immigration of foreign-born populations into the state is growing. So again, if you look at 1980, which is the very last column, you'll see that 3.1% of the population was non-European. And as of 2010, 9.2% were non-European. Why is that important? Because the people of color in the non-European is the growing population. If you go back to the bottom, 13.1% of the population is foreign-born in 2010, and that's almost a 5.5% rise since 1980. So, again, white population is dropping, populations of color going up, leading to an increase in the population of color overall. The third reason populations of color are growing is that the white population is aging while populations of color are getting younger. What we actually have in the report is that the mortality rate for whites is staying high while the mortality rate for the populations of color is going down, but I figure that kind of puts it in our face a little too much that we white folks are going to die off soon. So if you look at the median age by race and ethnicity, which is this slide, what you'll see is that the Connecticut population, the total population of Connecticut that's over 65 is 14%. Whereas the non-Hispanic white population over 65 is 17%. And if you look at the next three, non-Hispanic black, non-Hispanic Asian, and Hispanic, all three of those are much less than the non-Hispanic white population. And that's true in almost every single category. So it's very clear that as the population ages, it's going to get whiter. The elder population is going to be whiter while the younger population is going to increase in diversity. And so our population as a whole is going to look more diverse as the years go on. Of course, race and ethnicity are not the only protected classes, and that's not the only issue that we looked at. There's also disability, family status, and lawful source of income. There are several other protected classes, but a lot of the data on that protected classes is either not Connecticut specific or is not significant.
Excuse me, Erin.
Yes.
I want to interrupt you for a minute. I'm sorry, before you go on. Going back to the population growth issue, you put all this together, and what basically it says is that Connecticut is a negative population growth.
Thank
you. If we were to put a wall around Connecticut and no one moved in and no one moved out, there would eventually be more people dying than being born in this state. The only thing that's keeping a population growing is in migration, and in particular foreign in migration. So when you look at these fertility numbers, it was 1.7, I think, is the fertility rate. In order for the population to remain stable, you need 2.1. We're well below that. Thank you. Sorry.
Good. I'm glad you add things like that, because as I was going through this, there's so much data like that that I think it sometimes gets overwhelming, and I'm trying to make it as clear to people as possible, but I think you're right. I probably should not have left that statistic out. So the some of the demographics of the other people, and again, I think this has some significance for the where we're going to house people and the type of housing that we're going to need. 10.3% of the state's total population was disabled in 2010. A couple of important things. Obviously, as people age, they become more disabled. So if you look at the very bottom row of people 65 and older, the population there is has the highest percentage of disabilities, and of disabilities, 19.8% have ambulatory disabilities and yet are accessible housing. Housing that is accessible for people with ambulatory disabilities is not keeping up with that. People who have independent living difficulties, people who can't live on their own because of a cognitive disability or self-care disability or one of combination of disabilities is 14.4%, and that generally is going to mean an increase in the number either of supportive housing units or assistance to people who are disabled in order to have them continue to live independently. Yes.
Could you just quickly describe what ambulatory is?
Ambulatory is anybody who has difficulty getting around, so it can mean anything from people who are in wheelchairs to people who are using a walker or other kind of assistance to be able to get around. With regards to familial status, the number of families with children, 22.8% of the population of Connecticut is comprised of families with children. Single parent families are 30% of the population of families as a whole. And people of color are disproportionately represented among single-parent families. So if you look at the actual data, what you'll see is that of single-parent families, 47.9% are non-Hispanic white. The other 52.1% are people of color. So single families of color is definitely higher than white families of color. With regards to the lawful source of income, in this particular case, we're looking only at data for people who have Section 8, also known as the Housing Choice Voucher Program or the RAP program. People of color and single parent households are overly represented in these, in the HCV program and the RAP program compared to their percentage in the overall population. So if you look at the data, people of color are 29% or 28.8% of the population, yet the percentage of people of color with housing choice vouchers is 78%. Single parent households are 10.4% of the population, but with female-headed households with housing choice vouchers or Section 8, 53%. People with disabilities are only 10% of the population, and yet they have 36% of the housing choice vouchers. So there's some significant differences out there, disproportionate representation of people in the protected classes in the housing choice voucher population. Approximately 27% of Connecticut households are eligible for the Housing Choice Voucher RAP program, meaning they are income eligible. They would meet the income eligibility, and yet there's only been a 6.6%, and there's been a 6.6% growth in the population eligible for Housing Choice Vouchers or RAP between 1990 and 2010. Housing Choice Vouchers have fallen by 1.9%. And it grown by 81% since 2003. So the number of housing choice vouchers and RAP vouchers is not keeping pace with the number of people who would be income eligible for those programs. The one thing, in Orlando, correct me if I'm wrong, is that 27% of Connecticut households is all Connecticut households and doesn't look at whether or not some of them may already have housing choice vouchers or RAPs or maybe in public housing or some other kind of public housing. It's just a raw number or raw percentage.
I think so. We went with so many numbers.
Yeah, it's all families.
It's all families. So some of that 27% may already have housing choice vouchers, maybe in a RAP program, maybe categorically ineligible for one reason or another. So not that entire 27% actually needs affordable housing.
Okay. The decline in the housing choice vouchers, is that because of decline in federal
Absolutely. Yes, the federal government has been disinvesting in the Housing Choice Voucher program significantly since at least the beginning of the 1990s.
Have they been shifting the monies to some other program?
No.
That would offset that?
No. So one of the things that I was pointing out here is the percentage of people of color and single-parent households and people with disabilities that are currently receiving housing choice vouchers and the fact that they're disproportionately represented. So the question becomes, why is that? Why is it that people of color are disproportionately in need of housing choice vouchers, wrap certificates, or affordable housing? And so that led us to look at income, poverty, and membership in the protected classes. So this is not just looking at income separate and apart from anything else. It's really putting together membership in a protected class as well as income and poverty. And income and poverty are different. Income talks specifically about how much money do people have. Poverty talks about how many people in a particular category are below the federal poverty rate. So, and that's very different. Orlando, did you want to say something?
Yes, I just want to make it clear what we're using, the standard federal poverty threshold. For example, a family of three, it's about $23,000 a year. If you make less, a dollar less than that, you're under in poverty. If you make a dollar more than that, you are not considered in poverty. And this threshold is set throughout the country. It does not take into account cost of living. So if you're making $23,000 a year in Iowa, you're considered in poverty. And if you're making $23,000 a year in Fairfield County, you're considered in poverty.
Thank you. So in Connecticut, there's severe income inequality. Separate and apart from race or anything else, there is significant rate, income inequality in that Connecticut has the second greatest income inequality in the country. In addition to that, black families earn 55% of what white families earn, and Hispanic families earn 44% of what white families earn. This next statistic was surprising to me because it says single-parent, female-headed households earn 30% of two-parent households, and male-headed, single-headed households earn 44%. Clearly, still a gap in the difference of income between men and women. And, in fact, that's the next statistic, which shows that women earn 78% of what men earn. People with disabilities earn 67.7% of what people with disabilities earn. And let me just make clear that this is for people with disabilities who are actually have earned income. It doesn't talk about people with disabilities without earned income, and I'm going to talk about that separately. 95% of people using housing choice vouchers earn less than 50% of median income. So that's not a surprise since you have to earn less than 50% of median income in order to qualify. So this is what it actually looks like, and I think when you look at it on the bar graph, it makes the point really clearly. 24% of, this is with regards to poverty rates. So 9.2% of Connecticut lives below the poverty rate. Of that 9.2%, 5% are non-Hispanic white, 24% are Hispanic, 19% are blacks, and 8% are Asian. So clearly there is a people of color have a far higher poverty rate than people who are white. In fact, if you add those numbers together, I think what you see is 95% of the people living in poverty are people of color. Family status and income. So the average income for all families is $81,000. Married couples with families is 102, and that's all size families. So a family of three, mother, father, and child, or two parents and a child, or two parents and six kids, the average income is $102,000. Male head, single-parent families, average income is $45,000. And for single-parent female-headed households, it's $31,000. That's income. Poverty also tells a story. 15.5% of non-Hispanic whites in single-parent families live below the poverty level. If you add those next three numbers together, 84.5% of single-headed households, single-parent families, population of color, live in poverty. Very high rates of poverty for single-parent households for people of color, much higher than in the white population. People with disabilities earn 67% of what people without disabilities earn. 17.5% of people with disabilities live in poverty, meaning below the poverty level, and 22% of people with disabilities are unemployed. 4.8% of the adult population receive Social Security disability benefits, which is from the federal government and depends upon work income, so it's not supplemental security income. These are people that at one point worked in their lives and now have become disabled. Yes? It's anybody who is, Orlando, did you want to answer that? Or
it's anyone who has a disability.
Anyone who identifies themselves on the census as having one of the disabilities that I listed before, ambulatory, seeing, hearing, self-care, that kind of thing.
And some people will list multiple disabilities, but we didn't double count. So if you have, you know, two disabilities, we just counted one.
Okay, I was just making sure it just didn't come off of SSD.
That no.
Came
no,
off
no.
of everybody with disabilities.
Right. If it was just SSD, it would be 4.8.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. So the people with disability by age and poverty status, so 83% of all people with disabilities in every age category live below the poverty level. So that 17.5% figure rounded to 17. 83%. 2% of people below the age of 17 who are disabled live in poverty. 11% of people who are 16 to 64, and 4% of people over 65 live in poverty. So very clear that poverty is a huge issue for people with disabilities, and age, if you're between the ages of 16 and 64, higher poverty rates than for anyone else. So again, a lot of the housing is for elders, elderly people and elders with disabilities, and yet what we're seeing is that young disabled population has a far higher need for housing than the older disabled population because there's more people.
What we also found with the disability data is one of the reasons that among whites there's a lower rate of poverty among disabled, and we believe that's become because they have more access to pensions, income, than the minority populations.
So the other thing, again, we wanted to see what was the effect of poverty in housing voucher holders. So 78% of housing voucher holders, remember, if you're above 50% of median income, you don't qualify for a housing voucher, or it's very difficult to qualify for a housing voucher unless you fall into a categorical category, such as disability. 78% of the people with a housing choice voucher live below 30% of median income. 17% live below 50% of median income, and 30% are between 50 and 80% of median income. So very high rates of poverty in the housing choice voucher holders. Again, makes a difference as to what type of housing they can afford, because no matter where they're living, they're going to have to be paying some portion. So what does all this do? We looked at race data, we looked at national origin data, we looked at familial status, disability, families with lawful source of income, poverty. What does this look like on a map? How is it, where are people living? How are people able to find housing in Connecticut? And what we found is that while Connecticut's population is changing, the housing patterns are not. So 2 out of every 3 minorities in Connecticut live in just 15 of the state's 169 towns. So that's what Connecticut looks like. The darker areas have populations of color over 60%. The white areas have populations of color that is less than 15%. And the shadings are also marked there. Very stark segregation in Connecticut. One other measure of segregation is something called the dissimilarity index. And dissimilarity index is something that looks at segregation across a region. So if you were given a dissimilarity index of zero, then that would mean there was that the area was completely integrated, meaning that the percentage of people living in an area was very reflective of the population as a whole. If you have a dissimilarity index of 1 or 0.1, that would mean that there was absolute segregation. So everybody would have to move in order to be able to have an equal distribution of people across a region. And HUD has found that segregation values over 0.55% indicates very highly segregated area. And so the red areas are the areas that HUD would consider very highly segregated. You'll see that pretty much the entire middle and lower southwest corner of the state are considered highly segregated. The only area of low segregation that we have is the Torrington area, and everything else is moderate segregation, so very high levels of segregation. What does this – one of the reasons –
I just had a quick question about the Torrington area. Is it because there's a lack of people of color that live there?
Yes.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
And Enfield also has low segregation.
And low census and low population as a whole. Okay. So one of the things that the dissimilarity index allows us to do is compare Connecticut with other parts of the country, because when you're using the same measure of segregation, you can then put all LMAs, labor market areas, onto a map or a scale and see where people fall. So Bridgeport, with regards to Hispanic white segregation, Bridgeport is the eighth most segregated in the area in the country. Hartford is the ninth most segregated area. New Haven ranks 20th, and New London ranks 72nd.
Aaron, excuse me.
Yes.
I realize you may not have all these facts right at hand. Do you know, for example, what the area of Bridgeport includes? How far is it? I mean, all of southwestern Connecticut, or Bridgeport and its contiguous suburbs, or what's the?
It's the Bridgeport Stanford labor market area,
okay,
as defined by the Department of Labor, and that brings up a very good point, because you often say, "Well, you're segregated compared to what?" Okay, and the what is a big issue. So what we decided to use were the labor market areas, which are delineated by the State Department of Labor. And those are areas where most people live and work. Okay, now obviously not everyone does, but if you're in, let's say, if you live in the Bridgeport-Stanford area, you're most likely to work there. Vice versa, if you work there, you're more than likely to live there.
Well, and can I just add to that, the comparisons, the national comparisons, are actually not labor market areas. They're for statistical metropolitan areas. They just compare them differently on the national basis.
So Bridgeport ranks number 8, Hartford ranks number 9, New Haven 20th, and New London, Norwich 72nd. And one of the questions that I anticipated is, what's number 1? Reading, Pennsylvania. Springfield, Massachusetts ranks number 2. The only other places, or the two other places in the, three, sorry, in the top 10 are New York City, Providence, and Boston. New York City is number 4th most segregated with regards to white Hispanic. Providence is number 6, and Boston is number 7. No place else in the Northeast is contained in the top 10. Northeast is very, very segregated in terms of white Hispanic segregation. With regards to white-black segregation, Bridgeport ranks 18th, Hartford 34th, New Haven 42nd, New London, Norwich 128th, so not as much segregation in terms of white-black. Milwaukee ranks number 1 in terms of white-black segregation, and New York ranks number 2. No place else in the Northeast ranks in the top 10 most segregated when we're looking at white-black segregation. Yep.
Is there an explanation to the difference in rankings between black versus Hispanic?
Difference in population. So the population numbers are different, and obviously as a result of that, the segregation numbers are different.
Follow up a little bit. Also, the Hispanic population is larger in Connecticut than the black population, and the black population is even more concentrated than Hispanics. Okay, so when you look at segregation, there are more Hispanics in more parts of Connecticut than there are blacks.
So the other issue that Aaron and Orlando did was look at segregation by race, ethnicity, and age. Remember, one of the things that we are seeing with the statistics is that as we look at the population as it gets older, the older population is more white. So you'll see that large parts of Connecticut have a median age between 40 and 50 years old for the non-Hispanic white population. There's only one very small part of the Connecticut that has a large white population that's less than 25, and that's stores. So not a surprise that that's where it is. But let's look at what happens when we look at where the black population lives by age. And what you'll see is that the black population is, as Orlando said, much more heavily concentrated and concentrated by age. So a large parts of Connecticut have a black population with a median age of 25 to 39.9. But let's look at the northwest and the northeast corners of Connecticut where there are, first of all, very few blacks living there. So the population of by age is not there. The only place that has in the northwest that has a black population between 20 is the population between 25 and 39 in the Torrington area. There's no place in Connecticut that has a median age of 50 years or older for the black population. So again, reinforcing the fact that the black population is younger, much younger than the white population, and obviously much more concentrated. There's the white population pretty much scattered throughout the state, black population much more concentrated regardless of age. And here we have the Latino population or Hispanic population. Again, there is no place that has a median income of 50 years or older. Lots of places between 25 and 39, and a few places less than 25 years of age. There's no place with a median Hispanic population between 40 and 49. So again, very young Hispanic population, again, very heavily concentrated in just a few parts of the state. There's also segregation by disability, and this slide shows you the percentage of the town population that has a disability. So if you look at the third column, that's the order. So Wyndham has the highest percentage of the population of its population that's disabled. Look at the income rank of the population of Wyndham. It's 166 out of 169, and it has the highest disability population. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? The low income making it affordable, or the people who are disabled moving there because it's so economically depressed? Those are the 10 towns with the highest percentage. The 10 towns with the lowest percentage of residents having a disability. Darien has the fewest people with disabilities in in the state, and Darien has the third highest income in the state. So you'll see that most of the incomes on the right-hand side are very high income areas, again, making it probably unaffordable to people with disabilities. State is also segregated by single parent status. So one of the things that has been mapped here is where single parents live. Hartford has 20% of the population that are single parent families. Most of the other parts of the state have less than 10%. A few have between 10 and 14. The majority of ones with more than 10% have between 10 and 14%. Of the single-parent population. Housing choice vouchers, there's also a lot of segregation by housing choice vouchers. Remember, these are usually also called Section 8 vouchers. So the yellow part are minority population in excess of 30%, and the black dots are where housing choice voucher holders live. You can obviously see a lot of concentration of housing choice voucher holders in areas that are more than 30% people of color. RAP vouchers, which is the program administered by the state of Connecticut, shows very similar levels of segregation. So again, the yellow areas are areas where the minority population is 30% or higher, and the black dots are where the rental assistance program voucher holders live. There's a little bit more integration here. If you can compare, there's a little bit more integration, but really it's not significant. Mainly, there are just more RAP vouchers in areas of minority population than in housing choice voucher holders. So this is all looking at various types of affordable housing and where do people with affordable housing live. Remember that the RAP certificates and the housing choice vouchers are certificates that go with the person, so the person has the choice of where to live. And 85% of RAP recipients and 83% of housing choice voucher holders are living in areas that are disproportionately minority. So they have more than 30% of people in the area living in minority. And 75% and 79% of housing choice voucher holders are living in areas that are high poverty. So not just low income, but also high poverty. Yes?
I'm just intrigued by your use of the word choice there in terms of where they live. Is it really a... I guess, are all these folks really just choosing to live in the limited parts of the state?
I think that's part of what the analysis of impediments is trying to show by really putting, I think that one of the important things about this is putting together income, race, and national origin, because I think it tells the story about what we need to do and what the impediments to fair housing are, which is that, and you'll see in the next couple of slides, people who are, because the people of color are disproportionately low income, they are disproportionately in need of affordable housing. Well, where's that affordable housing? Well, here's one answer. So multifamily affordable housing, what this is showing you is that the green areas, the darkest green areas, are areas that are more than 90% white. The lighter green areas are the white populations of about 72 to 89%, and the white areas have a white population of less than 72%. So the bigger the dot, the more affordable family housing, multifamily housing. And this is about the change in multifamily housing. So you can see that since 2002, areas that have that are non-Hispanic white population between 72 and 89%, that's the area that gained the most multifamily affordable housing. The areas that lost multifamily affordable housing are the non-Hispanic white populations over 90%. So we're putting more affordable, since 2002, we've been putting more affordable housing in areas that have large non-Hispanic white population. I'm sorry, in areas that have white populations of less than 89%. So we're reinforcing segregation patterns in the way we did housing between 2002 and 2011. Another affordable, yes. Yes, I'm sorry. My statistics keep getting all mixed up. So what this is showing is the change in multifamily affordable housing between 2002 and 2011. So the bigger the dot, the greater the increase in affordable multifamily housing. Okay? The square red means that there was a loss of 500 units or more. So if you look at the areas that are the whitest, most of them lost affordable housing. The areas that gained housing in excess of 1,000 are areas with a white population that's less than 72%.
You can basically think of those areas as areas that are disproportionately minority.
So that's, is that clear, or do you need me to explain more? Okay, yes.
And how would a municipality go about losing 500 or more units of affordable housing?
You know, you take the change out of your pocket, you put it on your... So it has lost in different ways. Some of it is through deliberate decision-making to rehab particular units of housing. So in some areas, they will take a... Like in Hartford, Dutch Point is a good example, where they had X number of units of affordable housing. They decided to redo it, and they reduced the number of affordable housing units by Y amount. So some of it is going from all affordable housing to mixed, so some affordable and some not. Some of it is demolition, so they just took it out. Some of it is conversion into other types of housing that is not affordable. So we're going to take this housing and make it into a market rate unit or something along those lines. So there's a lot of different ways. Okay. The other, one of the biggest programs in the country for the development of affordable housing is something called the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program, and that is a program in which you get a tax credit in order to build affordable housing, and if you're going to get a credit, then you need to promise to keep a certain percentage of the units affordable for people who are low-income. And so what this is showing here, and again, the colors are the same, so the darker the color, the whiter it is, the lighter the color, the more people of color living there. And what you're seeing is where the development is of low-income housing tax units. So if you look at the chart at the bottom, 73% of all low-income housing tax credits are in areas that are disproportionately minority. 73% are in areas of high poverty, and 40% are in an area called RCAP, which is a HUD designation that looks at minority and high minority, high poverty concentration. So it puts those two statistics together, and 40% of those units were built in areas of high poverty, high minority concentration. One of the things that we often hear is that the reason that low-income housing tax credits or other kinds of affordable housing is built outside, cannot be built in suburban or outside of urban areas, is because it costs too much. But when you look at the difference between family and elderly housing, what you see is that it is possible to build housing outside of high minority, high poverty concentration areas. Because if you look at elderly housing, only 58% of elderly units are in minority areas, 55% are in high poverty areas, 36% are in RCAP areas. Compared to the family units, 76% of family units have been built in minority areas, 76% are in high poverty areas, and 37% are in RCAP areas. Again, elderly housing houses people who are elderly over the age of 65. What have we learned about people who are over the age of 65? They happen to be white. The supportive housing, I want to add a footnote here. You'll see that...
Aaron Bonds.
You'll see that in the supportive housing area... statistics that 96% are in disproportionately minority areas, 96% are in high poverty areas, and 63% of the are in RCAP areas. There are other reasons other than possible segregation, particularly in that the minority areas, the high poverty areas, also tend to have a high concentration of services. And so it may be a deliberate decision to locate supportive housing there so that people can have access to services that they might need.
Would you define supportive for us?
Supportive housing is housing that includes not just a housing unit, but other kinds of services that someone who is disabled using. It can mean anything from a sober house for people who are in recovery to one that includes types of services where people are coming in to actually provide help getting people in and out of bed or that kind of thing. Yes.
This map, what do each of the dots represent?
So each of the dots represents a low-income housing tax credit property. Okay, so there's nothing here that shows how many units go with each of those dots.
No, I think it's actually units. It represents the units. It's a percentage of units that are disproportionately.
Yeah, but the dot is just the location of the units.
Right, right.
So if you have two dots, it doesn't mean you have two units.
Right.
It's two properties.
Right.
Yeah, can I also just add something? I mean, the other thing I think it's important to understand about the breakdowns by disproportionately minority and percentage in high poverty areas is what percentage of the state those areas make up geographically. So the percentage of the state, the geography of the state that is disproportionately minority is 5.8% of the land area of Connecticut. So we're talking about 73% of the units in this program being located in 5.8% of the land area of the state. And similarly for the high poverty areas, I think it's 10.5%. So again, 73% of these units are located in just 10.5% of the state. The RCAP areas of the state, that's less than 1% of the geographic area of Connecticut. So 40% of the units are located in less than 1% of the state.
So the other type of affordable housing that we were able to map is federal public housing. This is housing that is owned by a housing authority and subsidized by the federal government. Again, you'll see that federal family public housing, 80% are in disproportionately minority tracts, 69% are in of the elderly public housing are in disproportionately minority, 89% are in disproportionately high poverty tracts, 76% are in elderly, I'm sorry, 76% of the elderly public housing is in high poverty, and with regards to RCAP tracts, 42% of family public housing is in RCAP, are in federal, I'm sorry, I'm speaking too quickly, 42% of federal family public housing are in RCAP tracts, and for elderly, it's 31%. Again, elderly housing is definitely less in less segregated areas. Yes?
Now, is this more a function of the age of the housing, so it was built 50 years ago and it was much more diverse then than it is today?
Well, it's hard to say because all of the elderly, it's not like the elderly housing was built more recently than the family housing.
Yeah.
So it's harder to do that without actually looking at the exact age. And I have to say with regards to the low-income housing tax credits and also the expenditures of DOH, one of the things that I was not able to do because DOH is still mapping it for us is expenditures of DOH in the last 3 years, and what that's showing is that there's a much higher investment in more diverse areas by DOH, and so they have been looking at that data and want to get it to us, and obviously, you know, 3 years isn't going to overcome however many years of problems, but I think that DOH is really making some significant strides in the right direction. All right, so, yeah, who cares? We're segregated. What does that mean? Well, where you live affects every aspect of your life, and this is something that we put out a report on, the Connecticut Fair Housing Center put out a report on in 2009 called the Opportunity Mapping Report, and it looks at, you know, what does where you live affect? It affects your educational opportunities. It affects your economic opportunities. And it affects the quality of the neighborhood where you're going to live in terms of will you have access to decent, safe housing, open space, fresh food, low crime, and public transportation. If you put all of those opportunity pieces together, what you see is that 81% of African Americans live in low or very low opportunity areas compared to 44% of Asians, 79% of Latinos, and 25.8% of whites. So much lower opportunity areas for African Americans and Latinos than for whites and Asians. With regards to high opportunity, Only 9.7% of African Americans live in high opportunity areas compared to 37.1% of Asians, 11% of Latinos, and 50% of whites. So much higher access to opportunity for people who are white than for people of color. And this is what it looks like on a map. So the darker areas are the very high opportunity areas. The green dots indicate between 1 in 500 people of color. So the more dots, the more people of color live there. So what you can see is that the high opportunity areas have very few people of color, and that the areas that are the lowest opportunity have the highest number of people of color. Yep.
Thank you. I was just trying to, I didn't want to make an assumption, but when we're looking at this chart, are we assuming that when you're defining high or low opportunity, simply, are you combining all of these areas, educational,
right. So
together?
Right, it looks at those three, educational opportunity, economic opportunity, and the quality of the neighborhood.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. And one of the reasons we do that is that it sometimes gives a more complete picture of a community than just looking, for instance, at poverty or one. So, for instance, a low-income area could be a higher opportunity area if it had high-quality schools. But a place that had very high income could be a lower opportunity area if, for instance, it had high rates of crime or something along those lines.
So, therefore, some of these areas that you're looking at, they might have a better school system but less job opportunity.
Exactly.
In the same. Okay.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Job is the next issue that we're looking at. So one of the things that segregation affects is access to jobs. And what this is showing is where the jobs are growing. So the darker the area, the higher the job growth. The lighter the area, the less job. Is that right? No, the other way around. Job growth is the lighter, above 15% job growth. So you'll see that in the upper northeast corner, there northeast and eastern part of the state, there's high job growth, but very few people of color because there's very few green dots there. And the other thing that's interesting about this is that a lot of the job growth is outside of our major cities. So Hartford, New Haven, and Bridgeport have very low job growth, whereas outside in some of the suburban and more rural areas, there are high rates of job growth. So segregation is affecting access to jobs because jobs are not growing in the cities, they're growing in the suburbs. Segregation also affects access to education. So if you look at poverty, race, ethnicity, and poor educational achievement, you can see that those are ranked. So the red line here is the percentage of families in poverty living in a school census tract. And so it's not the school itself, it's the census tract. And the three categories are basic, proficient, and goal. Basic being the lowest, proficient being the middle, goal being the highest, and that's based upon CMT scores. And so you'll see that as the poverty rates go down, the educational achievement is higher. And the blue is the percentage of students eligible for free or reduced price lunch. That is generally used as a measure of poverty in the school itself, since the eligibility for free or reduced price lunch is pegged to the poverty level. And so, again, the highest number of people with of children eligible for free and reduced price lunch are in the basic, and if you look at goal, very small percentage, only about 6% of that population of the people in goal schools are eligible for free and reduced price lunch. And then the yellow looks at the minority enrollment. Again, minority enrollment seems to be highest in areas with basic achievement on CMTs and lowest in areas with goal achievement. So there seems to be a connection between poverty, race, ethnicity, and poor educational achievement. One of the things that I'm trying to do is to see if there is any data out there on race, ethnicity, and educational achievement that does not look at poverty. So most of the data out there says schools with high rates of poverty also have high rates of people of color and also have high achievement. Is there anything that shows that simply integrating schools, regardless of poverty rates, would make a difference? I'm not sure it really makes a difference in Connecticut because there's such a connection between race, national origin, and poverty. One of the things that has been talked about is why not put people who are low income next to high performing schools? Well, one of the ways to do that is through the High Housing Choice Voucher Program through the creation of affordable housing, because as I said, housing choice, you can go anywhere. Some of the public housing, you can go. A study done by the Freeman Institute in New York, at New York University, looked at MSAs throughout the country, metropolitan statistical areas, and for tenant-based vouchers, Hartford ranks at the bottom, meaning that out of 100 areas that were studied, the number of housing choice voucher holders living near high-performing schools, Hartford ranked 99, New Haven ranked 97. For project-based vouchers, that means that the voucher goes with the unit. Hartford ranked 84th of people with project-based vouchers living near high-performing schools. New Haven ranked 97th. Public housing, 69 and 65. And the low-income housing tax credit, 73 and 82. So not doing a great job of putting affordable housing near high-performing schools.
Thank you, Erin. I'd like to take this opportunity just to have the committee reflect on one idea here. We talk about the K-12 achievement gap a lot in the state between whites and minorities, one of the largest achievement gaps in the country. And I'll ask you to think about this a different way. Do we really have a K-12 achievement gap, or do we have a housing segregation or social isolation gap? Which is it? Is a K-12 achievement gap a consequence of housing segregation?
Another effect of segregation is on health. And so this slide looks at the darker the blue, the greater the minority concentration. And the yellow dots are plants emitting air pollutants. So you'll see that the higher the minority population, the more plants, and I don't mean like plants that grow, I mean manufacturing plants, emitting air pollutants, I think the slide speaks for itself. Segregation in lead paint. So where do children with lead paint live? Again, the darker the area, the whiter the population. In this case, the highest levels of lead poisoning are in areas with a non-Hispanic white population of less than 72%. So you'll see that the highest rates of lead paint are not, it's not really just dependent upon the age of the housing. And that's what we often hear is that, well, the cities have the highest ages of housing, and yet there's old housing, and, you know, Connecticut's one of the oldest states in the country, and yet we don't have as high level of lead poisoning in all parts of the state, highest in areas where there are the most non-Hispanic white population. So where does this all lead us? What are the impediments to fair housing? And I have to tell you that I'm giving you broad strokes. I've spoken for 1 hour, and I've really just skimmed the report itself. And so please know that there's a lot of subcategories to these impediments. These are just broad strokes. So there's a lack of affordable housing in a variety of locations. Why does that matter? Because people of color are disproportionately low income. Therefore, they are disproportionately in need of affordable housing. Where is the affordable housing currently in Connecticut? Right now, it is currently in areas with high poverty, high minority concentration. majority-minority areas, so areas of high racial and ethnic concentration, are also areas of concentrated poverty. And so we see that the areas that where most people of color live is not going to attract people who are white people to live there, because there's not it's areas of high poverty, and as a result of that, it has all of the problems that go along with high poverty. One of the reasons for this is that there isn't enough coordination, or there has not been enough coordination between federal, state, and local actors to promote integration and to affirmatively further fair housing, and that the access to housing is limited by housing discrimination and ignorance of the fair housing laws. So what are the action steps that we need to overcome that? So in order to have affordable housing in a variety of locations, we need to continue to fund affordable housing. And as I said, DOH has really made some strides in doing that. That needs to continue. We need to facilitate the development of a variety of housing tenures and sizes in a variety of locations. So housing tenure talks about, is it rental? Is it home ownership? Is it for elders? Is it for families? And the size talks about the one-bedroom, two-bedroom. And what we saw is that, in fact, a lot of the family housing, affordable housing, is in areas of high concentrations of poverty and minority. Elderly housing is in areas that are less concentrated. So we need to continue to develop housing in a variety of locations. I didn't really get into any of the statistics on home ownership because I thought that you would all kill me if I continued to throw statistics at you, but we need to continue to fund affordable home ownership opportunities. CHFA is doing this, but we need to make sure that we're doing it in a variety of locations and to really look at that data as to where we're making affordable homeownership opportunities available. We need to continue to assist homeowners in foreclosure in an effort to preserve existing housing and to stabilize neighborhoods. So this is one way of making sure that the affordable housing that exists continues to exist in a form that people are actually able to live there. And the other thing that I didn't get into is transportation, because transportation obviously plays a big role in all of this, because where if you don't have access to public transportation, you may not be able to get places. And so we need to expand access to accessible and support. Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot expand access to accessible and supportive housing. We don't have enough accessible housing. We don't have enough supportive housing, and we don't have it in a variety of locations. We need to work with municipalities and create incentives that address barriers that prevent the development of affordable housing. So one of the things that Aaron Boggs talked about the last time was zoning issues and other kinds of barriers that prevent municipalities from developing affordable housing. They need to be addressed. And we need to use transportation resources to assist in making areas available to everyone. We need to invest in high poverty areas. So one of the ways to do that is to promote mixed-income housing in areas of concentrated poverty in order to promote desegregation. If the majority of people who can afford mixed-income housing are people who are white, one of the things we can do is promote mixed-income housing. At the same time, we need to continue to preserve existing affordable housing and promote transition of affordable housing to mixed-income housing, so not just leave it as affordable if that's not going to promote a mix in the population that lives there. Continue to assist homeowners in foreclosure, especially because our inner cities and our cities are being more heavily affected by foreclosure than other places. Coordinate housing and economic development to create job opportunities in high-poverty areas. As we saw before, job growth is mostly in the suburbs, but at the same time, we want to be able to raise the economic level of the cities in Connecticut to make them areas of higher opportunity. And again, to use transportation resources to assist in making areas available to everyone. Coordinate efforts of federal, state, and local actors who are who affect the housing market, so expand work with state municipal officials to educate them on how, not now, to affirmatively further fair housing. Ensure that state planning documents coordinate to affirmatively further fair housing and promote integration. And evaluate the work of federal, state, and local agencies to assess their efforts to promote integration and affirmatively further fair housing. Finally, I really didn't get into any of the individual statistics about housing discrimination. And so one of the things that we think needs to happen is to educate municipalities and provide support to overcome local barriers to affordable housing. I know that was said before, but it's also an education issue, and it's an issue that can prevent access to housing, even if there is housing, affordable housing in a particular area. Sometimes discrimination by a municipality or local actor can prevent people from getting into it. Continue to fund efforts to fight housing discrimination by both public and private entities, and expand education of the general public and housing providers on the fair housing laws. So those are some of our action steps. Again, there's a lot of sub-steps that go with that, but those are kind of the broad strokes.
Are you aware of other states or parts of the country where they've had similar situation and been successful changing the direction?
So the everybody has to do the analysis of impediments that we talked about, and Massachusetts has done one recently, California has done one recently, a lot of people have done them recently, and I think there's the question is then what about implementing action steps, and I think that that has it's still hard to see a lot of change. So, for instance, there was just a decision by HUD yesterday about Dallas and their efforts to address race discrimination, and HUD found they were really doing a very poor job. And so I think that it's a very hard issue. As you can see, there's a lot of different pieces. It's not simply a question of let's build more housing or let's move people or whatever. It's a very moving target, so I don't know of anybody that really can say we did this right and it's now no longer a problem.
Representative Case.
Thank you for the presentation. I could probably be here all afternoon asking questions.
I'm surprised anyone's still awake.
One question I have for you also is there any way we can get this email to us so that we can actually see the color charts?
And, yes, Peter Peter has it, and he can email it to people.
In doing a little of my own research over the past, since our last meeting, finding impediments, and I'm glad you touched on it last, it happened to be transportation, because working with a couple who gets SSD and working to get them to Department of Social Services so they can get signed up, and there's no transportation for them. So we have to find that for them, which I did find. I found a transit that would go out of their district and go pick them up and take them. And then I had another person who I went down with who's working, and their job hours got cut, so they went to see what they could get. They were able to get money for food, but because they're not disabled, they can't get money to help them with their housing. But he can't get to a job because the job that is available to him is third shift and there's no transportation. So that, I think, to me, that's the bottom line. If we can get transportation to people, especially being up in the northwest corner, it's a huge issue. And just today somebody called me. They had to get to Hartford, but they had no way from the northwest corner. The Northwest Transit would only take them as far as New Hartford.
Right.
And then you can't, the first transit bus is in Canton. So that's a long walk.
Yeah.
but, you know, they had an appointment in Hartford to try to further them with their situation. So I think transportation is one of my
and not just existing transportation, but I think that when we're planning transportation in the future and we're thinking about it should be done in conjunction with the development of affordable housing so that we're not saying, well, we can't put affordable housing there because there's no transportation, but maybe the transportation can be routes can be altered in order to do that, as well as altered for people who are living in existing areas that may be needing it. So I think that
you know, because you find it interesting, right. One of these families I was with, they're actually living in the woods, and they come through, they come out of the woods, and they can't get medical insurance because they can't get to DSS.
Right.
And now they both have pneumonia.
Right.
So it's just a disheartening thing.
Yeah, and it is.
I tell you, great presentation. And
thank you. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Coach.
I'd just like to follow up for a minute and let Representative Miller speak. When we look, transportation is a big issue, but I'd like to think about this a different way. Instead of moving people to the services, moving services to the people. Now, some would say, well, that's economically inefficient, that it's more economically inefficient to put all the services in one place, less overhead, less duplication. But I'd argue that there is a social cost to that, that we often do not take into account, and that when we think of transportation, we should think of both getting people closer to the services.
Just to follow up on that, I think it was maybe 8 years ago or so, the state of Connecticut decided to take social services out of all the small towns and move them into centralized locations. Like in the town of Winchester, where I live, we used to have social services in our town hall so people could get to it right away. Now they got to go 10 miles down the road. So we did have that system before, and I guess what you're saying is getting back to that system so that it's in the smaller communities once again.
Yes, and because it's one of those, it's easy to get an economist or an accountant to say, okay, if we consolidate, we're going to save X number of dollars. But they don't tell you all the other costs that are going to come from doing that concentration. And I would hope that looking forward, we look at the transportation issue from both sides. Thank you. Representative Miller?
On purpose. I tried to take a button off my speaker. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if anybody read the Post the last couple of days, but we're talking about impediments to fair housing and affordable housing. And in the city of Bridgeport, the Bridgeport Housing Authority, they own a parcel of land in the south end of Bridgeport, and it's the city's property. And what they're going to do, they're going to hire a contractor to put up housing for people who need housing, you know, for the poor. And the contractor is going to get paid $400,000 a unit.
And now, it's next to a coal-burning plant.
Pardon me?
It's next to a coal-burning plant.
Yeah.
And in a floodplain.
That's
and
exactly
isolated
right.
from
exactly
all the services.
Exactly right. You got that right. Now, where the heck are they coming from?
They're coming from Marina Village.
Are they reading any of this material that you were giving us? Do you think they're reading that? Or maybe they're not possible. They can't read.
Well, we told them.
You know, $400,000. And it's our, you know, city property. And they're going to rent it. The developer's going to rent it out and make money on the property.
Direct ocean view. Need I say more?
Come on, what the heck is wrong with us? Really, I get so frustrated and I just don't understand what the heck is wrong with this state. You know, a big impediment is to fair housing is education. And who runs the education? Government. I think government's the biggest impediment to housing laws than anybody. And yet we go through these meetings and we discuss a lot of good. There's some unbelievable stuff in here. Very comprehensive. The statistics are incredible. But then you look at the Bridgeport Housing Authority and you say, what is wrong with those people? Maybe they got the marijuana plants going in Bridgeport earlier than we thought.
No, direct ocean view, very high.
Yeah.
Of course, you're going to be living in the ocean,
I make light of it, but it's not really something to make light of. It's awful. It's a shame. And that's government. And it's a city I was born in, and I love Bridgeport, and I can tell you, I spent my greatest years in Bridgeport, and I can't believe what they're doing. So I just wanted to make sure everybody's aware of that. Read the article. This young lady over here has all the information. Ask her to get you a copy. But it is nuts. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Now to Professor Dougherty from Trinity University. He's been Trinity College. He's been sitting here eagerly for about an hour, and also welcome his students on the side of the room there who've come along. And hopefully Professor Dougherty will help us to understand how we got into this position.
Good Let's take just a minute to switch over. Great. Took about a minute last time. Peter, last time took about a minute to switch over. Should we give it another second or two? Let me pull it out, pop it in again. Greetings. Thanks very much, Representative Butler, Mr. Rodriguez, and members of the task force. Thanks for inviting me today. My name is Jack Doherty. I'm an associate professor at Trinity College. I lead something called the City, Suburbs, and Schools Project. My area of specialization is history of education and urban areas and suburban change over time. That's how I've sort of grown more into housing over time. By coincidence today, students in my City Suburb School Seminar are here. It happens to be your invitation came on the last day of our class, so rather than me questioning them, they get to watch you question me and enjoy it thoroughly. I'll be relying upon them for some support. I have 12 slides to cover about 100 years, broad strokes, because what historians do well is I think sometimes we offer stories, we offer lenses for sort of how to make sense of what's happened over time and how do we arrive at where we are today. So the questions that I was asked to focus on today are questions such as, how have barriers to fair housing evolved over the past several decades in the Hartford region? I was invited about 10 days ago, and my focus has been primarily on Hartford area, the cities and suburbs of the Hartford region. I certainly understand we have many members from other parts of the state here, and if I don't have answers for you today, perhaps you'll be curious to learn more about whether or not the dynamics we've seen in the Hartford area have been replicated elsewhere, and that would be a good topic for further study if that's of interest to people. I've also been asked to emphasize what sense the role of government action or inaction has played in this process about changing barriers to housing over time. And also, how does this history affect us today? I work with a number of young people, undergraduates. This is extremely, if this is old history for us, it's actually even more distant for them. But there are future here. Many people actually in Connecticut want to make sure that younger people stay in Connecticut, and trying to sort of see what role they can have in shaping the future is important. And that's why I'm glad you've invited us here today to sort of see more of the policymaking process. The argument I'm going to make today is that sort of comes down, I try to boil it down this way, like I encourage my students to be able to make a succinct claim about what they're doing before I show you some evidence that supports it. While racial barriers to housing in Hartford in particular, but in large parts of Connecticut, they've become less overt over time. They've become more subtle. But local government and state government has very much continued to allow exclusionary housing by wealth-based measures, such as exclusionary zoning. And I'm trying to emphasize how both these past actions and present actions are shaping what we live with today. The racial barriers have been changing. A lot of the wealth-based barriers have been continuing over time and taking some of their places, but both are still with us. So let me walk through some of the evidence that draws from this. And as I said, everything I'm drawing from today comes from the Hartford region. My apologies for the local focus. And the City, Suburbs, and Schools Project is where a lot of these links are from. So I have links in the presentation today that point to particular sources or websites we have. And that whole presentation is available online, or you can follow the Twitter feed I had at the beginning. Also, Peter, your clerk, is putting up a link to the presentation with all of its links that are mentioned for everyone to access today. It's all publicly available. I often start my students at the beginning of the semester sort of looking at, just trying to get a broader view of what's happened with racial change in an area like the metropolitan Hartford region just over the past 50 or 60 years. And when they see this kind of map, this is a time slider map that we created with my colleagues at University of Connecticut, the Map and Geographic Information Center. You can find the link and actually explore the map yourself. But when we look at this map, my students, whether they're from Connecticut or whether they're from afar, they're often drawn to this and they often ask questions. Questions like, why are the racial groupings of students of families in the metropolitan Hartford area, why does it vary so much from town to town? In other words, there's not a natural story, a natural evolution that happens with race over time. You actually have a number of
markations. You can actually look at the map, and even if we erase the town boundaries between, say, Hartford in the center, South Windsor in the upper right quadrant of there, or parts over on West Hartford or the Farmington Valley, even if you erase the town boundaries, you could actually still see a lot of the racial divide still there. Why is that? Why is it happening that way? How are the racial patternings we've seen over the years sliced up so differently over time? And to help them understand how we got here, where we are today, I walk them through different kinds of barriers that my students and who before them and I have found in our research. Some of them are extremely overt racial barriers. A lot of people are surprised to find that here in the north, in Connecticut, my students and I looked through the property records in the town hall of West Hartford, and we found in the 1940s that there actually are five or six developments that we've found so far, just in West Hartford, there may be more in other parts of the state, where written into the property deed, the developer in the 1940s actually had a racial restriction. The fine print on this says, "No persons of any race except the white race shall use or occupy any building on any lot in the entire development, except that this covenant shall not prevent occupancy by domestic servants of a different race employed by an owner or tenant." That's surprising for a lot of us. Actually, sometimes veteran civil rights activists I've talked with in the Connecticut area have said that they were surprised to see that this language existed and actually technically still exists today in property records. Now, back in 1948, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that these were unenforceable, but it's important to remember that up to that point, towns, governments were the legal repository of these records and were enforcing these restrictive covenants in property exchanges that are governed by the state. And even when you sort of state that it's no longer enforceable, that, you know, the language is still there. Other regions of the country have actually tried to strike out the language of these restrictive covenants. Connecticut might want to look to see what we should think about doing with our history of our restrictive racial covenants. Moving on from some of the more overt barriers, my students and I have also delved into some records that come from the National Archives in Washington, D.C., because these barriers are often about redlining, and sometimes it involves actually what the federal government has done in cooperation with local lenders. Banks, mortgage entities. During the Depression in particular is a good example here of this redlining map that comes from the 1930s. During the Depression, the federal government, very eager to sort of put a boost in the housing economy, where it was very expensive beforehand for people to come up with a large down payment, often 50% or more back in the 1930s, the federal government was very eager to sort of implement more mortgage-friendly policies for possible home buyers. So back in 1937, the federal government created this map here, which my friends and I at Magic have digitized into an interactive version. You can click the link and actually explore and see more of what's happening here. The federal government, the Homeowners Loan Corporation, was working with local lenders, local banks, to actually do a neighborhood-by-neighborhood risk analysis. Where's the most likely places to have a good investment, trying to encourage private lenders to reach out with more funds? So this is known as a redlining map because, if you see in the legend here, the neighborhoods with the highest quality of mortgage possibilities were in green, and moving down from blue to yellow to the fourth grade. The riskiest areas were known as the red areas. Now, other scholars have checked to see whether or not redlining meant you got no loans, and actually, you know, there's debate about whether or not there are actually many cases of where in redlining areas some people did actually get loans. So it didn't mean it cut off entirely. But the big point to see here is that the federal government, along with local lenders, was working through different neighborhoods, giving a risk analysis based entirely on the geography of the neighborhood, and in particular, they were downgrading neighborhoods based on the race, the ethnicity, and the social class of the residents. I actually inserted here a little screenshot of actually what comes out of the form from the federal government in the 1930s. Built into the form itself, there are some questions about what's the housing stock look like, is it brick or is it wood and so forth, but there are many other questions about who are the inhabitants, who lives there. And in the language of the times, in fine print it says, what's the percentage of foreign-born families? What's the percentage of Negro families? Are there any infiltrations? Remember the language of the time. In this case here, this is all out of a Blue Hills neighborhood in Hartford. This is, at the time, an infiltration of Italians, is what the federal agent writes down. Are there relief families, or in the language of time, families on welfare living in this neighborhood? And then there's clarifying remarks. This is disturbing to a lot of us, but it's important to see our history, and I want to read this one out loud. This is actually from an area with very few African Americans, but look at just what the federal government with local lenders was writing up about neighborhoods such as this area in Bloomfield. A somewhat newer section which extends into the town of Bloomfield, this is actually just it's B5, the Hartford neighborhood that just goes up to the Bloomfield line. It is largely given over to the, quote, to the Hebrew race, wrote the lenders at the time, although the better class Italians are now moving there. Architecture is not overly pleasing, lacks variety, plots are giving the appearance of some congestion. Though some dwellings are more desirable than the average and show pride of ownership, the area as a whole rates a low blue. My students look at this and they say, well, this is striking because it's not just the housing stock. It's not just the physical characteristics. It's who lives there was shaping who was treated as a higher risk or a better bargain, a better investment for mortgage lending. And it's our government, federal government, along with local private organizations that were doing this as well. Sean McCann is with us today. Sean, just raise your hand, please. He's written an excellent essay if you want to read more about this one here. You can just follow the links if you wanted to on the presentation. Another type of overt barrier that my students are really struck by is what we see in terms of political barriers that local municipalities raised often against the federal government in regard to public housing. Here's another local example. This is from the West Hartford area. During the 1940s, we have a tremendous wartime emphasis of putting more workers on the assembly line, the Rosie the Riveters and others, to sort of help the U.S. And create more armaments. And certainly, the Hartford region, with all of its wartime industry, was pivotal in this for winning the war effort. The federal government had to face extreme shortage of housing for wartime workers, and so was creating a lot of public housing, which was a prized commodity at the time. Remember, today, a lot of my 20-year-olds or 19-year-olds think of public housing just with stigma terms. But if you go back to the 1940s or 50s, maybe you're familiar with some white families, what we consider as working to middle-class families, were extremely privileged to get a spot in public housing at the time during extreme housing shortages of the 1940s and 1950s. What's striking here, though, is locally elected leaders responding to West Hartford white residents blocked African-American workers, Negroes in the language of the time, getting many positions in public housing at the time. This is a headline from the West Hartford Metro News, a newspaper that no longer exists, from 1943, that was actually quite gleeful in its expression of joy that white residents and elected leaders, congressmen and senators, were getting involved in trying to find creative ways to block the Roosevelt government at the time from granting full access to African Americans. The loophole that the locals came up with was to restrict the wartime housing only to African Americans who had previously resided in West Hartford before the war. That's how they effectively blocked the large changes from happening. And Emily Meehan, Emily, just raise your hand. You can read more of an essay from her on this as well, just sort of see how our past shapes our present in terms of public housing barriers as well, and government action involved in this also. If I take it up to the 1950s, we see more and more documentation, very widely documented. This is sort of like the open secret of Connecticut, that Negroes, even with money, can't get a place to live. This is the Where Can a Negro Live? The Hartford Courant ran a whole series on housing discrimination, not just the city of Hartford. This is very much seen as the suburbs as well. And the lead story in this multi-part series starts off with that atypical case of the African-American, I believe it's a physician, who has the income, has the ability, the means to purchase the home, but can't get the white real estate agents in the suburbs to actually show the property. They have never returned the calls, or once they find out he's African-American, they say there's just no way that's going to work. One of my students, Emily Hennigan, Emily, raise your hand here, wrote a fine essay on a shocking case of what looks at the surface is just sort of like, well, this is just private discrimination on the surface. You know, I've got a real estate agent who's refusing to rent or to sell by race. But I'm emphasizing here that it's state government that was very slow to enforce a lot of these laws or slow to react well to this. And sometimes it's even conflicting measures within state government. Emily identified the story here of Samuel Cullors. He's the African-American man in the right of the picture there. He was actually the principal planner for the Hartford Redevelopment Agency. It was quite interesting. He was shaping a lot of housing for the city, and in his own attempt to get his own two-bedroom apartment to rent in during his time here in Hartford, he was continually told there were no vacancies by the firm that ran the housing agency. He actually, through the Connecticut Civil Rights Commission, the predecessor of today's CHO, won an initial discrimination case, but later was overturned in Connecticut courts because he couldn't prove intent, that there was intent to discriminate. Though certainly the court even acknowledged that there was certainly suspicious facts, that whenever he tried getting an application, they always said they didn't have any or they didn't have any space available, even though other whites were shown to get housing at the time. And then I want to bring this a bit more to the more recent present. If you're hearing historians talk about the 1940s, 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, that can still feel very distant. I often point out to my students here that there's a 1989 piece that the Hartford Current ran. Some of you may remember when this came out. It was part of the Two Connecticut series. You can actually see the headline down below there. This is some of extensive work that people have done to actually test housing discrimination with black and white tester teams and so forth. These were current reporters who went to 15 real estate firms in the city of Hartford and in suburbs around Hartford in 1989. What were their conclusions? Well, maybe the glass is half full. Depends how you want to look at it. Out of those 15 firms, 8 of them treated white buyers more favorably. 7 of those 8 sharply questioned the finances of blacks, but not white. Can you show us your income? Can you prove you can afford this? 2 of those 8 firms wouldn't even show homes to blacks without financial documents, where whites weren't required to show those. 6 of those 8 firms, once they agreed to show properties, were steering whites and black buyers from very different neighborhoods based on the racial composition of the neighborhoods. And the Hartford Current looked at this and said, even if the other firms, so out of the 15, they labeled 8 as highly segregative, even out of the others, so that's all the firms, except for one case, whites were still treated better, slightly better. And I emphasize here that this is a case of, while the overt racial barriers may have been diminishing over time, we're still seeing them in subtle forms, and I encourage people for more present-day information on these types of cases, check out the recent news with the Connecticut Fair Housing Center cases. Certainly, it's not always government action that's the problem. Sometimes it's the inaction, either where we're relying on nonprofit organizations and their resources to do the investigative work, or whether we're relying on underfunded agencies to do the enforcement work. This is the kind of inaction that I'm trying to emphasize and help my students and others see more broadly. Now, I want to shift for a second and remind people that while those overt racial barriers are becoming more subtle over time, you know, we don't have, thanks to the 1968 Fair Housing Act that you've heard about in a prior meeting understanding, since we've had some enforcement and gotten rid of some of these overt racial barriers, it's important to see the other type of barriers that have been there for nearly 100 years and continue to have a strong presence today. And here I'm pointing to exclusionary zoning. We look back and found that back in the 1920s, actually West Hartford was the first municipality to take advantage of a new legislation that the state had passed to enable local municipalities to have their own local planning zoning board. So West Hartford's actually the first one to put it together. They hire a consultant from Cleveland who comes in and helps them come up with a land use plan. And when we actually look at the actual text of that document, which you can see, and it's the link to the 1924 zoning study, and I have a piece of it excerpted there below underneath the black and white zoning map on the left side and the present-day one on the color side. It's interesting here because local municipalities are finding out that they can regulate land use to promote more expensive housing. How do they do it? Well, you know the way this works. You can write the rules in local zoning regulations so that it promotes more expensive single-family construction in neighborhoods by dictating what's the minimum lot size that a house needs to have for a certain family or something like this. These are all the common zoning regulations we think of now, sort of the requirements that are written into law that on the surface are colorblind. There's nothing in the laws that is racially overt. But we certainly see that intentionally, the design was to make that affordable multifamily housing, to make it uneconomic to build. In fact, right in 1924, you can actually see the plan itself says, while three family houses and apartment houses are not prohibited in the what they called zones A, B, and C in large portions of West Hartford at the time, the erection for the most part will be rendered uneconomic by the lot area, lot width and side yard requirements, all of which will increase with the number of families to be housed on the lot. Back in 1924, people are thinking about how to sort of do this without overt racial means of, well, how to do what? How to block lower-income families from residing in neighborhoods that developers are being encouraged to build for higher-income families. My students, Fionnuala Darby-Hudgens, some of you might have met her a year ago when she was also speaking in a similar panel. We've collaborated with Aaron Kempel and others at the Connecticut Fair Housing Center trying to sort of like make sure we've got more information about zoning in Connecticut. As you know, Connecticut's divided up in 169 different municipalities, and each of those local agencies, with the exception of maybe one or two, actually has their own very detailed zoning documentation. We had to create our own website, our own repository of all the zoning regulations for each of those because there is no centralized mechanism in state government to which I'm aware of that actually does this for you. So you can follow through on the Explore Maps and zoning data to sort of figure out what we had to compile, where we have 169 towns, different zoning regulations, and try to figure out, well, how can we make maps that sort of show where multifamily housing is permitted? On that one map there, not permitted is in red, by special permit is in yellow, and it's the light green there. It's by right. You can certainly have multifamily housing in that area. And we did this because I think our argument was state government isn't closely monitoring what local municipalities are doing with their zoning privileges that they've had since the 1924s. And this is a large part of what's shaping our reality today. Now, my last slide here is back to my 19 and 20-year-old students with us today. How does this past, how does this present, how does it affect us today? A lot of students come into my class, and their world of housing, because they've never bought a house, rarely have any of them rented a house. I actually make them do a simulation at the beginning of the year so they can see how difficult it is. But many of them come into the class thinking, the world of housing is just a world of supply and demand. Because we often get sucked into these Zillow maps. Maybe some of you have seen maps like this where you go to the website and you type in a neighborhood and it tells you all the housing prices, all the area. And you understand that, gee, housing is more expensive in some neighborhoods than in other neighborhoods. Well, it's not just due to natural laws of supply and demand. I mean, the market is operational out there, but there's also a history underlying the market that affects us still today. And it's the history of not just the market, but also of government, government action and inaction. The housing prices that we see today and the benefits that are accorded with them can be traced back to not just natural market forces, but the accumulation of these past and present government actions and inactions. In other words, think about it the following way. My mother, she was born in 1941. She was born into a house, not in Connecticut, but in a similar area, where she later inherited the house, inherited the value of the home from her mother who passed away, and inherited all of the privileges, the financial ones and the non-tangible financial ones, the non-tangible ones as well, that came along with having a house that had been protected by state government or left alone by state inaction to be able to exclude people from moving into that neighborhood. That house that was for sale at a certain price in 1941 when my mother was born, that she inherited, the privileges and the financial benefits she reaped from that housing value going up over time with the protections it had, that's something that my generation is inheriting now. I try to emphasize with my students that what do these barriers really mean? These barriers mean that we live with a legacy today where many of us have inherited some privileges that we don't always stop and recognize where they came from. That's the purpose of my presentation today. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for your presentation. I did have one quick question about your a slide early on about the population of Harford in the early years going right there. Now, I'd say a lot of our cities in the early years, especially 1950s, there's migrations of many people from the South, and they would go to the cities where there was employment. As we know, heard from the report today, that the employment isn't the new employment opportunities aren't in the cities anymore. They're on the outskirts, which is interesting. But would you say that the people actually stayed in the cities because of the services and the low-income housing that was available, or is there anything else that you attribute that to?
Great question. Based on a lot of the reports that were written at the time about African Americans often coming from southern states to northern jobs, often invited by northern employers to take positions in agriculture or industry in Hartford, many of the reports make it very clear that the reason we see a tiny little sliver of African of minorities, African Americans mostly, in the northeast corner at that time of Hartford, just that tiny little sliver there, is because that's the only place where they could find housing, often the lowest quality housing that had been redlined from years earlier. But often it's the restrictions for where African Americans could find work or could find housing to go along with the work that they were invited to do force them to reside in certain neighborhoods, often the lowest quality ones. So I think if you try to talk about it as a matter of choice, we have extreme example of the least amount of choice for newly arrived migrants in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, and 50s in areas like Hartford.
Question? Representative?
Yep. Thank you for your presentation, and thank you for your students for coming out. Trinity's a great college. My father graduated from there and went off as an All-American to the majors, so it's a great tell for Hartford. But you talked briefly about trying to find a lot of the information, and in one of the communities that I serve, in order to get some grants, you have to have your POCD in line. And there's a lot of information. I was just reading through one of the POCDs, and it gives you a lot of the different, like what was in your report, Aaron, that type of information of the smaller communities. It's a very expensive mandate that the state has to put onto towns, so a lot of towns are behind on getting their POCDs updated. But I believe that would help in the studies that you do, so that we can find the impediments, because that helps us find out where we can do put fair housing, because it actually has a section on fair housing in there and what you're going to offer up to the community and apply for grants for. So I thank you for your presentation, and I always look at the POCDs and see where they are, and hopefully we can get more towns to complete them.
I've actually, for this report, looked at a lot of plans of conservation development for towns, and most of them, as I recall, don't actually discuss race at all. So that might be one thing legislatively that could be, or regulatory, in terms of regulation, could be added to them. So that's part of what you should be thinking about when you're doing your planning.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank Aaron and his students for a wonderful job. One of the first documents I got before we started all these meetings was a 75-page document that dealt with the Northeast, New England. But here we are dealing with reality, Connecticut, Hartford. And we have enough universities in this state, whether you talk about Norwalk Community College, dealing with the city of Norwalk. Stanford has a branch of UConn up there. Anything going on in Stanford? You can take a bunch of young people, and they do a fabulous job, especially when they're interested. It's their state, and they may be familiar with the area. And they accumulate this data, and it makes more sense to us than that big report I got from the beginning. This tunes into local stuff. Bridgeport has the University of Bridgeport, Housatonic, Fairfield University. Why can't we get these kids and professors to do study in what's happening in Bridgeport or New Haven or Britain or whatever? It just blows my mind. We just don't utilize our students that well. We should. And what you've proven that you've got a lot more in the presentation that you made than we got from that document, 75 pages from PhDs and all these wonderful organizations upstate someplace in Massachusetts or wherever they're from. But again, I thank you, and you did a great job.
Thank you, Representative Miller. And I agree. I think actually what my 20-somethings over here have on me is that I'm more focused on how we got here. I think by inclination, you know, they put up with me on the history side because I make them do it. They're very inclined to figure out how are we going to get moving forward. And they're often more likely to sort of like raise questions that people don't often, you know, to sort of challenge assumptions that many of us carry. They're often the first to sort of like to, to question why is our housing policy and our education policy often in such separate silos? Why are there different agencies or different committees that sort of are dealing with these things as very much separate issues? And what could happen if people thought about integrating your education and your housing policy, as Aaron referred to today?
Professor Rojas?
Representative Rojas. I wish I was smart enough to be a professor. on your exclusionary zoning today, Matt, and if you're able to, can you kind of explain what not permitted means, by special permit means, and by right means? And not permitted, if I'm making an assumption, is that legal for it to not be permitted?
Right. So in many places, okay, so if you can just put in, and I think it was affordable rather than multifamily, right? This map, is that the affordable or multifamily map?
This is the map 3 multifamily housing permitted.
So if you can just, as a developer, buy a piece of land and put in multifamily without going through an extensive zoning approval process to get a special permit, that's multifamily housing as a right. And then in the towns that are yellow, you have to go through the permitting process. And then the towns that are red, it's just not allowed at all.
How does that hold up legally or in the context of affirmatively housing?
There are a number of provisions in the Connecticut statutes that sort of move towards requiring affordable housing or multifamily housing to be permitted in any town. The most important one is 8-2 of the general statutes that says towns must permit both kinds of housing. So I would say those towns are running directly into 8-2 and a couple of other statutes.
And it's just a matter of that nobody's challenged the towns in court?
That's my understanding. Yeah. Or not even, some of it might be the Attorney General's office, for example, bringing attention of the town to this omission.
And then by permit, you know, that it sounds rather passive, right? You just go in and apply and you get your permit. Is that reality?
Well, it's too bad that Liz Verna just left. I think that's where affordable housing and multifamily housing run into the biggest problem is getting that special permit. That's usually where things stop because it's a matter for the zoning board just to vote up or down. And, I think in many cases it's not permitted, especially in those sort of what we call the higher opportunity towns.
Sure. And I don't know if either of you can answer this. Given New England and Connecticut's uniqueness of not having any county level of government, do we see states where there is county government chipping away more effectively than, say, us that doesn't have county government? Or are housing being mm-hmm. done on a regional basis as opposed to this individual town basis?
I think that's something it would be good for Connecticut to take a closer look at that because, you know, as Aaron Kempel pointed out earlier, you know, there are a lot of problems in the New England region. I know yeah. New York has counties. They still have problems.
Yeah.
So I think that would be worth digging into. I think a lot of it depends on how that regionalism is carried out. So you could have regionalism in Hartford, in the Hartford area, but if all the housing was still put in Hartford, then it yeah. wouldn't make a difference.
Yeah, and just for the record, I'm not advocating county government before people's hair gets lit on fire.
Just to add on that, Representative Rojas, that's the link that I was referring to. This is the Connecticut Zoning Initiative. It's just one part of our website that we partnered up with, one of my students in particular partnered up with the Connecticut Fair Housing Center. And I think what's useful here is, as you thought about this before, when you have your position in state, on this task force, and you're sort of trying to sort of wrap your head around what are 169 different municipalities doing? Well, take advantage of the sort of homegrown database that came together because the Connecticut Fair Housing Center spent its labor and my Trinity students spent their labor following up with all these municipalities to figure out what do actually your zoning regulations look like and scanning them all and putting them together in this database so that people can sort of like read through town by town on certain criteria about multifamily housing and so forth, but also could just sort of be able to see it on these types of maps that allow people to sort of click on a municipality in particular and see more details, or even further down, actually, one of these links is actually taking you right to the actual, to actually go see the actual document itself. Maybe it's this one. Yeah, I'll figure it out later on. But one of these will take actually the document itself. I think this is an incredible resource that's not perfect. I think the team found that it was challenging to come up with ways to sort of like find a metric that makes sense of all these different 169 zoning municipality regulations, partly because they all make up their own rules. They all follow their own definitions. And furthermore, how they define zones is textual. They'll describe an area, or maybe they'll have their own hand-drawn map of it, but we don't have a neat way of sort of figuring out how many square miles of Connecticut is zoned for or against a certain level. I think that's, if the task force wants to take on more of a fact-finding role or to encourage state government to take on more of a fact-finding role about what is zoning doing to us here in Connecticut, perhaps we could help you answer some questions or lay out some good questions that we think need to be asked based on our prior experience with this small project.
Some regional plan associations have sort of geo-mapped the zoning in the towns they oversee, but not. I think it's a definitely minority. And I think that would be a great thing to do for the state as a whole to really get a fix on what's going on with zoning.
Representative Miller?
You had a scam about different towns with their zoning. Do you have that for 169 towns in Connecticut?
You can see it as a sort of a scroll there, or you can actually open it up as a spreadsheet. Here's the full spreadsheet. You can click on the full spreadsheet as well. And also you can actually see the scan of every individual town. I just have to go back and find where the link is. I can't. It should be within the spreadsheet as well.
How do we get a copy of this? Oh, we just go on the internet?
Peter's already sent it out to everybody.
Oh, you did?
Yes, I have a note to remind everyone here that all the presentations have been emailed to all the members here, and all the presentations are already online. So just so you know, thank you, Peter, the clerk of the Planning and Development Committee. Appreciate it. Representative Case?
Yeah, just real quick, going back to the POCD and the way you guys studied it, from my understanding is, for any state grant or something, you need to have a POCD in place. I know my town, my hometown, has spent close to $100,000 just to redo their POCD, but you can just make a minor change and submit it to the state. But are we really looking at those hundreds of page documents to see what's in there for fair housing and see what's, you know, are we actually looking at them, or are we just making these small towns' unfunded mandate move forward? Or is it a working document? What would you say?
So one of the things that we've said in the AI that I did, you know, that was part of the detail is, but, you know, when we're talking about coordination among state, federal, and local actors, that's part of what we mean, is that there's a lot of different planning documents. There's the consolidated plan, which the Department of Housing has to put together in order to be able to get certain kinds of funding from HUD. There's the POCDs that local organizations have to put together in order to get funding from the state. All of these should really be coordinated to ensure that they're affirmatively furthering fair housing. And the short answer to your question is I don't think anybody is really looking in a critical way at any of these to say, yes, they do affirmatively further fair housing or comply with the law or whatever. The other thing is that we are talking with Department of Housing about putting a lot of this data onto a website, one single website. So your town is doing their POCD. They want to know what's the percentage of our town based upon age and race together. That's the kind of thing that you'd be able to go onto the website in order to get, which we hope would make it easier and less expensive for you to do the work and also make the document better so that it would be responding to several different things. Some of the real challenge of doing this is just getting the data. I think Aaron and Orlando can tell you they've spent hours geocoding data, and you know, so as I'm giving you what is really hundreds of hours worth of work to get it into the form that we can tell you. And if we had to start over again tomorrow, I'm not sure that it would take a lot less time, just because there is so much difference in data between the federal government and the way the state government keeps it and local government. I mean, Jack just touched on one area. There's lots of areas like that.
I just wanted to make sure with the POCD and any document we do when we go for a grant that these are actually used and looked at, and it's just not, okay, it's on the checklist, your POCD is in the packet, you know, and it goes down further. Just that it's a working document and we go for it, because our committee here, I mean, the impediments to affordable housing is a critical part that should be looked at every time, and every time these documents are updated.
So one of the things that I can tell you is that DOH has really changed the way it is qualifying people for various grants that they administer. So in order to be able to qualify for some of the SHARP grants and the CHAMP money and everything else, the affordable housing money that the state is putting out, something like 37.5% of the points right now have to do with fair housing, and it's the highest number of percentage of points of anything. So you could, for instance, put together a perfect, you know, plan that's funded and blah, 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 and you're not going to get it if it doesn't meet certain fair housing criteria. And I think that DOH is continuing to look at that in order to ensure that the way they are spending their money affirmatively furthers fair housing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, and I'd be remiss if I didn't point out, as you had alluded to, Professor Doherty, you talked about the history, and you showed us the beginnings, the humble beginnings, and as we progress through the years, and you're more interested in how we go forward in solutions, and we're fortunate to have the Department of Housing Commissioner, Commissioner Klein, here on this panel, so hearing everything that we've actually discussed today, and so we're very fortunate. Wanted to point people in the solutions is certainly here sitting at this big table, and hopefully we'll be the one of the largest advocates towards a solution. But I do want to tell you that, you know, I mean, you gave a presentation that showed numbers and practices of the past, but I have to tell you that, you know, being African American, I can still remember when my parents finally saved enough money to go buy a house, that they were only shown houses in certain parts of the town that I live in, and even before they were able to go look to buy a house, even where you could rent, you know, there's only certain sections of town they would allow you to rent in. So I could tell you it's data on a slide, but having lived it, you know, it's something that is real, it's tangible. And so we need to all keep that in mind in terms of going forward. But I have to say that the presentation today by Aaron, it shows that racial and poverty and disabilities, you know, it's profound. This is a profound issue. I do want to say to the students that, you know, you heard a lot of this, and it's looking at minorities and poverty. But I say, going forward, you see disproportionate amount of minorities that are affected. But please remember, you may look next to you and see a minority and say, oh, that's a tough time, but going forward, the new minority is going to be the socioeconomic class. You're going to be discriminated against because of your socioeconomic background. That's going to be the new racism or disadvantaged class of people. So it's important that we keep that in mind and do something now that will be fair across the board, regardless of race. Poverty doesn't have any color. Anybody could be impoverished. So we need to address this and take it head on. But again, thank you for your presentation. Is there any more questions or comments for Professor Doherty? Aaron?
Oh, well, I just want to highlight as another impediment that something that we experienced in writing this report is the lack of data. And, you know, that should just be highlighted. And we as a task force might think about how to get the state to a point where it's collecting data that is, you know, that can be used together. And, you know, for example, some agencies have different towns. You know, there's no set list of towns. Some of them are using the sub-towns in Connecticut, and you have to sort of figure out where they're what they're talking about. So I would just encourage us to put that on the list of impediments.
I'd like to thank Aaron and Professor Doherty and his students for coming. And being a geographer, I think what you do is fantastic, and I think your students are very lucky to be in such an applied program. It's the best of what we can see from universities. I really do honestly believe that. Thank you very much. And I'd like to pose a question to Aaron Kempel and Commissioner Klein. Is it possible to get someone to speak to the group about the process of citing a new property? You know, what are the criteria? What are the questions that are asked? Aaron, would you be willing to do that, or should we get someone from the Department of Housing?
I think that it's probably Nick and somebody from Connecticut Housing Finance Authority, because remember the program right now that is creating affordable housing is the low-income housing tax credits. What DOH is doing is providing funding for mostly rehab and that kind of thing. Am I right?
Well, I think we definitely could come in and do a presentation because we provide funding across the board. So the focus is, and I think that would actually be a good idea. I mean, I've been sitting and listening and collecting, you know, writing notes, and certainly this is information being a part of other interagency groups and whatnot that we are aware of, and we are looking to not, you know, we're trying to look to solve for all issues, because as we know, affordable housing is a need across the board, and you're right, it's poverty knows no race, right? It's exactly what you were saying, Representative Butler. So we'd be happy to come in and talk about, I think, our process and how the department is working. And I think, Professor, you'd be happy to hear that the agencies and your students would be happy to hear that the agencies in this administration are working together to look at how we can form partnerships to address a number of issues. And coming up, the way we handle our funding, since the governor has and the legislator, and thank you all very much for supporting the amount of funding that we now have to invest in our cities and towns across the state to build more affordable housing and to meet our need, we have organized our awarding of funding into funding rounds, and there some of them are competitive. And what we have coming up in March, because we did look at our funding rounds and we asked ourselves, you know, what's missing here? What do we hear a lot about, and what don't we see when we get these applications in? And we were missing transit-oriented development. That's high on our list. Affirmatively furthering fair housing and ending homelessness. So when we thought about our last two categories, we were actually thinking education. So, but there are broader issues to that, you know, and jobs and so on. So there's a lot for us to talk about, and we can do that in a concise way, and we'd be happy to come in and make a presentation, provide information, and focus in on what we do, what we're looking for, and make it interesting for everybody. So, you know, I appreciate this is my first meeting, so I typically do a lot of listening at a first. So I appreciate your question and look forward to the next meeting.
Okay. And if I could just put in a request, I was also interested in the housing choice vouchers, the vouchers that we make available, seeing that we've lost so much federal funding for vouchers. And I'd like to know what we as a state have available. I know the need is great, so if we could take a look at that and present some numbers around that. One of my missions personally is to start looking at how we can address homelessness, because there's far too many homeless people that are out there on the streets. And I know that we've had federal programs that funded a lot of what we could do in terms of some of these vouchers to get people, you know, from being out in the tents and under the underpasses to actually in some kind of housing that has dried up. If we could take a look at that as well, I mean, because I guess we could talk about fair housing, but, you know, making housing available to homeless, I think, is a fair idea, too. So hopefully we could take a look at that, too, in terms of what we have in terms of vouchers or whatever programs that we fund to help transition the homeless into various shelters. Is there any other?
Just sure, and I will say that as we see the declining numbers in federal support, what we see from the state is more state support. So again, thank you for that. So we are trying to meet that need, but we can provide you more information.
Okay, thank you. I believe that's it. If we don't have any other questions, thank you for.